This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, offering the largest selection of audiobooks for your smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter. Visit enterpriseinspace.org for more information. And if you'd like to help us keep Star Trek discussion coming to you each day, consider becoming a patron of the network through Patreon. Visit patreon.com/trekfm and find out how you can become part of the team. That's patreon.com/trekfm.
I'm Jeff Combs. I'm everywhere on Star Trek, and you keep tuning in to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 176, A Clever Lampshade. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me this week is Norman Lau. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including new casting rumors and confirmations for the next film, and the alien race fans most want to meet. Then in the feature, we're joined by Will Wynn and Philip Gilfus to discuss the Enterprise episode, Judgment. So let's step into The Ready Room. Hello, Norm. It's great to have you back here with me on The Ready Room. I have to say I'm a little bit jealous because I saw those pictures of you working in the Axanar booth at WonderCon recently.
Thank you, Christopher, for having me back on. It's always a pleasure to be here with you in The Ready Room. It's not often that I get a chance to do this because of my schedule. Many people that listen to Warp 5 know, and many people who are on the Babel conference know that my schedule is fairly hectic, so it truly is a treat for me to be here and to be able to discuss Star Trek with you once again, because this is how it all started between you and I and a short conversation we had on Patreon. So, and that's funny. I'll segue that into WonderCon because that's how I started with Axanar. And it was a huge, huge trip. Fun. Fans were great. Alec in the booth looked fantastic. Diana Kingsbury, the coordinator for all of the perks, she looked even more fantastic. And Robert,
we always call her the lovely Diana Kingsbury.
That's the lovely Diana Kingsbury. Yes. And Robert Burnett actually had a semi-near finished pressed copy of the Blu-ray in the booth, and the picture looked exquisite on
that's what I hear
the new 60-inch TV that's part of the booth. So
yeah,
it was really a treat for all of you who were able to make it to WonderCon in Anaheim. Please put that on your calendar again, because it is a fantastic show. It is what San Diego Comic-Con used to be in terms of size and comfort level, and I recommend definitely being there. Even if you don't stop by the booth, if you're a fan of comics, please sure to make that a destination for 2016.
Definitely. I hope I can get there one of these days, because I just want to take in the con experience. You know, living here in Japan, I don't have an opportunity to go to Star Trek conventions and mingle with Star Trek fans. And maybe I could do it for Star Wars, but maybe, especially coming up as the movie's on its way. But Star Trek, no. So one of these days, perhaps. But Norm, looking at what we have to talk about in news today, apart from Axanar, there's relatively little Star Trek news that caught my eye. But one thing that is persistent is the rumor mill surrounding the next film. And of course, last time we talked about Idris Elba possibly signing on to play the role of the villain, but that has not been confirmed still, as far as I know. In fact, I think Simon Pegg has been denying that. But one thing that does seem to be confirmed by Deadline is that the Algerian actress Sophia Boutella, who people know from Kingsman, has signed on for a lead role in the film. Now, I know that you talked about Kingsman with Matthew on the 602 Club recently, so tell us a little bit about her and your thoughts on her being in the film.
Well, the funny thing is about talking casting when it comes to the next movie, some of my friends who aren't as well-versed in Star Trek, they keep asking me, who's going to be cast in the next movie? Well, The logical Vulcan kind of snooty answer is, well, all of the actors that you've seen before.
Right. Chris Pine. Zachary Quinto.
Simon Pegg and, you know, the standard, the usual suspects. But Sylvia Boutella, at least in The Kingsman, from what I know, she is absolutely a gorgeous, gorgeous young woman who was the femme fatale, i.e. the odd job, if you will, of the movie. She was Samuel L. Jackson's character's henchwoman who ran around on a set of very deadly prosthetic blades, and she used those to great effect. In fact, she was pretty much like a human Cuisinart in some scenes.
Okay. Now, you know, rumors were that, or the thought process was that Idris Elba could be playing a Klingon. Do you think she's going to be running around on a field of batliths in this next film?
If she did,
we talk about blades?
If she did, Mark Miller, who was behind the project, I think he would probably have a trademark infringement issue with that. But it would be cool. It would be cool. I don't think we've ever seen like batliths or the personal short swords ever prosthetically applied, but this is Star Trek, and I was about to say J.J. Abrams, but it's not J.J. Abrams. It's Simon Pegg now. So
this is Pegg, the Peggverse.
Yes, this is the Peggverse, and not to say this indelicately, but these hopefully aren't Pegg legs, if you will, you know, because it just wouldn't work, I don't think. I think one Kingsman movie is enough for that kind of effect. But going back to the actress, looking at her physically, definitely a possibility for a Klingon matriarch or consort or...
That's what I was thinking as well.
Yeah. I mean, she's very young. Yeah. Again, she's very attractive. And I wouldn't throw out the possibility of an evil Vulcan, i.e. Cybok.
Ooh.
Because she has those types of physical features. Anna Alexander is an actress who Christian Gossett has for Axanar, and they share these similar, very clean and high cheekboned Middle Eastern features. And that's very much akin to what Jolene Blaylock looked like as T'Pol, and several Romulans in that same type of look. So I wouldn't put it past them to perhaps throw her in a Romulan role just because she already has 75% of that working for her naturally.
I'm going to stick with Klingon personally because I just feel like I don't know why exactly, other than they've been underutilized up to this point, but I feel like we're going to get more Klingons in this film. I think that fans want to see that, and I think that as they're writing the film and they're looking back, they can sense that the frustration of fans a little bit that we've been teased with Klingons, and I still think that even in Into Darkness, we were teased with Klingons.
Well, like, sure.
We could have seen a lot more than we did.
Yeah, and the Klingons in that role, they were really pretty much an action element vehicle for that scene in particular. There was really no world building for the Klingons there, aside from seeing the set pieces on Kronos, aside from seeing the Klingon bird of prey, or the bird of prey for this non-prime universe.
Yeah.
And we didn't see, obviously, any female characters involved. So it would be neat if, in this universe, if this particular character, Sylvia Boutella's, and we're going to say that she's going to be a Klingon, if she ruled the roost. That would be really interesting. Kind of like the way that Azet Bor did in Star Trek VI. Because once Chancellor Garkon was assassinated, she really did hold all of the power, even over General Chang.
Ooh, so maybe Idris Elba is going to be in there, but get assassinated in the first act, and then Sophia Boutella will take over.
It's a possibility. I mean, that I know that there's a lot trending right now in media with putting stronger, more capable, and definitely more intelligent and well-written female lead characters in film. And I think that because it's Star Trek, they should take that responsibility and look at a Klingon character and not even just put a Klingon female in there, put a really capable, well-written, and very intimidating Klingon female in there. Something, a force to be reckoned with, finally, on that side of the fence, you know, for female characters, especially for Klingons.
So one last tidbit here, Norm. Did you know that she also spent several years as a dancer on tour with Madonna.
Now, that I didn't know, but her flexibility in The Kingsman and not necessarily her acting flexibility, because she really didn't have any words. She was kind of a mute assassin. Mm-hmm. She is definitely has the dance moves, and I would pretty much stay away from any of her bladed apparati, if you will, if she was on the dance floor.
Okay, good advice, good advice. So other than this, we have no real idea of what role she'll be playing. According to Deadline, she has actually signed on, so this does seem to be different than the Idris Elba one, which is a rumor, and this seems to be confirmed. So it doesn't give us any real clue as to what form the first story of the Pegverse is going to take.
One last thing, though, is I always like seeing new talent and new characters on familiar properties like Star Trek. It's something that allows them to build a little bit more into the world that we're well-established and well-steeped in from a trivia and from a lore standpoint. So it'll be nice to take that kind of an advantage. And I think that Simon Pegg is smart enough to see that as something that's new for Star Trek fans, as opposed to trying to shoehorn in somewhat of a modified trope, if you will.
Yeah. We'll see where it goes. All right. So the other thing we're going to talk about today is a StarTrek.com poll, which we do from time to time. And I pulled this one out because I found one of the results kind of interesting, Norm, which we'll talk about. Now, this poll asked, if you could make first contact with a Star Trek alien, which of the following would it be? They got more than 15,000 votes. And I think it's important to say here that all of the aliens that we're going to list, those were given as options on the poll by StarTrek.com. They weren't write-ins, which might explain why the one that caught my eye is in there in the first place. Because I don't know why people want to meet the Borg, but they're in there. But Norm, starting at the top, tell us what the results are.
Well, on the very first option here, we have 52% of the results coming in for Vulcans. I'm not sure if that's a huge surprise for fans, but given the popularity of the Vulcans as a race, Spock's popularity, and probably in the wake of Leonard Nimoy's passing, everyone was thinking about Spock a little bit more. So
yeah, it could be. I think it could be 50% of these people are female fans who want to meet Spock.
And I'm sure some of them are or would like to meet T'Pol. But that's just me being selfish.
Right. Well, no, I say that because just over the years now, like 5 years of talking about Star Trek on Twitter with people, I've just found what kind of surprised me going in, but I guess it shouldn't have, how many female fans love Spock, and specifically Leonard Nimoy Spock, mm-hmm. not so much Zachary Quinto Spock, and also Bones as well. You know, so many people love DeForest Kelly. That's something that I've observed, and that's the reason for that comment. But for me personally, I'd probably want to meet a Vulcan too. They seem like, because I like science. I like trying to look at things in a logical way. I think I would probably get along pretty well with most of the Vulcans.
I think the only humans that didn't want to meet Vulcans were the humans in Montana in A Mirror Darkly Part 1 at the very beginning when Zefram Cochrane pulled a shotgun.
Right.
On our first contact situation with the Vulcans. I think everyone else is pretty much on board with Vulcans. At least 52% of us are.
Now, Norm, if you met a Vulcan, what would be the first thing that you did with them? Would you play Ooby Dooby for them?
I would. I would want to know what the hand gesture meant, really.
Okay. That would be your first question?
No, actually, that wouldn't be my first question. I would definitely play Ooby Dooby for them, for sure. Okay. And I would probably
do some shots, right?
Yeah, do a couple shots and show them how to dance and maybe have them fix our jukebox, you know, because it's a slow starter.
And then later on, you can ask them about the hand gesture.
Well, after a couple of shots. But here's the thing with aliens. We're assuming that their metabolism works similar to ours. So kind of like Legolas could outdrink Gimli like 10 times out of 10. I'm pretty sure Vulcans, with the history that we know of Romulan ale, I think they could pretty much drink any human under the table, with probably the exception of Bones.
Okay. Or Scotty. Scotty could take him.
Sure.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially Scotty, because Scotty can drink way more than the average human. So he can drink aliens under the table.
Actually, matter of fact, the last time I was here on the Ready Room, he can drink Klingon nerve gas that's been watered down.
Oh, that's right.
He can drink Theragrin derivative and really still operate all of the engineering at Starfleet level.
That's right. We did Spectre of the Gun. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's funny. Okay. So the next one on the poll, 21%. So a huge drop here. Mm-hmm. Bajorans. Would you like to meet Bajorans?
Absolutely. Because, and I say this with a huge apology to the Niners out there, I'm not the biggest well-versed Deep Space Nine fan, but what I do know is that they are very deeply spiritual people, and I dig that. I also dig all the orb chambers because those are things, they're just really cool looking, and I love the orb of mail. Who doesn't love getting mail from an orb? I love the orb of time because in that way we can retcon away pretty much anything we want, including Klingons with bumpy foreheads. Now, all kidding aside, though, I think that the Bajorans are a really interesting people, and I think that the first time we were introduced to a Bajoran was in The Next Generation, Ensign Ro Laren. Yep,
that's right.
And she was very stoic for an alien race, and then we understand that they're very spiritual people. They had their issue with the Cardassians. I say issue so lightly. They had their war with the Cardassians.
Yeah, they had some serious issues with the Cardassians.
So maybe pull up a chair, hang out with them in the temple, polish an orb or two. I think they'd be pretty cool.
Well, they also make great spring wine. And just Bajor itself as a planet is always portrayed as being a very beautiful, lush place. And it seems like it would be a very nice place to visit. It reminds me actually of some places here in Japan. Actually, if you can get out kind of out the direction that I live, when you get out towards Hakone, where you have very relaxing environments. That's what we so often see when we see landscapes of Bajor.
I was always super impressed with Vedic Wynn and the way that she just maneuvered politically through their culture. And Louise Fletcher as an actress is fantastic, but...
Well, Louise Fletcher redeemed the character, because without her, I'm not sure. You know, I can't stand the character, but... she does such a great job of making you hate that character that you can really appreciate that.
And that observation, observing her as her character, probably informed me more of what I didn't know about the Bajorans, because I didn't know that there was this, or at least with her and maybe with some of the other Vedics or some of the other Bajoran politicians, I don't know, there was a certain underhandedness in the political schemes of what was happening. So I find them to be very interesting because I just don't know a lot about them.
Yeah. Well, the next one, 11%, Andorians. Now, would you want to meet an Andorian, or would you be worried that you were probably going to get your ass kicked?
I would definitely want to shake hands with Shran, then punch him, and then have him punch me, and then probably have Andorian ale.
Right,
over the course of a great conversation, and then we'll probably go into like ice cutter fighting. I'll probably lose because he's a master at it, and then I want him to say on record that he would take my blood to Andoria.
I'll take your blood to Andoria.
I don't know. I love the Andorians in Enterprise and Warp, you know, that universe. They're fantastic.
I can see you asking him, can you record my communicator message for me? I will take your blood to Andoria.
I love it. And Jeffrey Combs can only do it in that special way. Now, I think the Andorians were probably lining up as my probably second favorite race species on Enterprise and in Star Trek, because we finally got to see their motivations throughout the course of the 4 years, or at least as much as we could. I always felt that they brought more honor to the guise of the word honor than the Klingons did in that sense, because that's what Shran was all about. He and the Imperial Guard were about Andoria, about furthering the greatness that is their planet, that is their culture. We saw more of that. And when Shran vowed vengeance for honor, he meant it. And we saw it in spades, especially in the Babel arc, because that's what informed everybody that Andoria is a fighting partner with the Federation, and they mean what they say. Now, sure, there were a couple of underhanded things that Shran did, but he always did it for the glory of Andoria. So I think that they were pretty straight up, and what you saw was what you got for the most part. But Shran, Jeffrey Combs being the underhanded guy that he is, as Shran was, you know, he had a lot of depth to him. But overall, and I also love the color blue.
Yeah. Yeah, the Andorians, for me, visually, were always one of my favorites, all the way going back to TOS. And I was always disappointed that they weren't used more in Star Trek, so I was really excited when I found out that they were going to appear on Enterprise. And then I was very excited when I actually saw them on Enterprise, because they did such a great job with the makeup and with the antenna, because it could have come off as just completely cheesy, but instead it came off as really awesome. And Shran, yeah, great character. And I don't know if I would necessarily, I mean, if we're coming down between Vulcans and Andorians, I would rather meet Vulcans, but I can definitely see why people would want to meet Andorians as well. And now I'm picturing you headbutting Jeffrey Combs, and I'm also hearing Peter Cetera sing about the glory of Andor.
Oh, that's right. You know, we're gonna bring Karate Kid Part 2 all the way into the ready room. I love it.
We did it all for the glory of Andor.
He's like a knight in shining armor from a long, long time ago. Just in time here to seize the day. Take me to Andoria far away. I can go there. I can go there, Chris.
That's awesome. Okay, so now we're getting down into single digits here. 6% Klingons, 4% Romulans. So these are the two baddies, right? The Klingons and the Romulans, kind of traditional baddies on Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Would you really want to meet either one of them? And if so, which one would you prefer to meet?
Well, this is actually really interesting, because I think that there are two different classes of Klingons, if you will. You have the original series Klingons, which I think are awesome. And then you have the non-original series rest of the Klingons, which are also interesting, but not as interesting to me as the original series Klingons. And I think it's just what we know of the Klingons has been so well told that I don't feel that I'm going to learn anything new unless I meet a certain litigator from 2151 who
we may talk about later.
Dun, dun, dun. And for all intents and purposes, the Klingons are the villain of Star Trek. They've been told time and time again about their history, about their class structure, about their perception or their struggle with the code and ethics of honor and family and government. I mean, I can go on and on and on and on, and I think that's why I wouldn't really care about meeting them right now, because they're just pretty well explored, if you will. And the same thing, well, I'm surprised that the Romulans aren't higher than the Klingons.
Yeah, the Romulans are much more interesting to me because they're very scheming, they're very devious, and they're... Not that we learn this much about them on the television series, but the way that they are portrayed, you can tell that they're a very complex society, whereas the Klingons seemed, at this point, and as we'll talk about in the feature today, become really dominated by the warrior class, and what you see is what you get for the most part. Romulans are a lot more difficult to figure out, so I would prefer, between the two of these, to meet Romulans.
Just to see a little bit more, just to see if, okay, do you only really have one textile pattern for all of your clothing?
Right.
You know?
So this is the one that caught my eye next up here at 4%, the Borg. Norm, why would anyone want to meet the Borg?
Well, you know, some people in human society are just joiners, you know? They just are. They like being part of a collective. I mean, I know that on Earth we've had our communes where people can show up, they lose their identity, they become part of this larger force that's greater than themselves.
Okay, this is true.
You know, and perhaps later on in the future, you know what? It's either hanging out and making baskets or creating other drones of ourselves. It's all good because we're all part of the same thing. We have the same common goal. And you know what? It's even better being part of the Borg because now you just share one mind, one collective hive mind. And It's just easier that way. You don't have to Facebook or Twitter or text anything. You just think something and everyone else thinks the same thing, which is good and bad, I guess.
Yeah, that could be in our future, actually. But yeah, I mean, I guess I can see. I mean, you mentioned these communes. It's actually true. And I guess I could see a few people being into that. But overall, the question is, you want to make first contact with an alien. Well, if you make first contact with a Borg, you're going to become a Borg. So don't know why you would want to meet them in this sense. Well, maybe observe them from afar, as Seven of Nine's parents tried to do.
I guess we have to take this whole thing. Now, we're taking it from the standpoint of what we know. But say you're out there in space and you see a giant cube made out of wires and piping. Just because of who we are as humans, and we're on the, let's just theoretically say, the NX-01, on screen, there's this ship out there, and it's this cube. First of all, wow, that's something that looks completely dangerous, because why would a ship look like a cube? And then all of a sudden, it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger, and they're not answering our hails. I would be a little nervous. I'd be like, I'm not sure if I want to do first contact here.
Yeah, same here.
You know, and then all of a sudden, a little globe thing pops out of the back. And now you have two strange-looking ships, and none of them are talking to you? I'd be like, maybe we should turn around.
Now, my car is a cube. That's the actual name of the car, a Nissan Cube. If you saw me driving by, would you also be nervous?
Only if you put the Borg on your vanity plate. Borg 1.
I've actually seen that. I think it was a photo from Canada or somewhere where they were selling a Nissan Cube. Mm-hmm. Someone did do a personalized license plate that says Borg.
The Borg Cube.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we can't personalize plates like that in Japan. Otherwise, I would probably do that.
Are there antennae on these? Because then you can stick a Borg sphere on your Borg Cube.
Oh, and then you could do that.
You can completely round out the cosplay, if you will.
Yeah, I do have the Borg sphere from the Starships collection, so maybe I could add that to my car. Okay, well, last one here as we wrap up. 3% would like to make first contact with the Ferengi.
That's interesting, only because that people would rather meet the Borg than meet the Ferengi.
That's a good point, yeah.
You know?
What does that say about the Ferengi?
Right. Now, if you're looking to, you know, if you're looking to find straight shooters and people that don't really negotiate well, okay, you got the Borg. They're like, join us or we'll assimilate you. These are your two choices. The Ferengi, you have how many rules of acquisition? So you shake their hands and like, hi, how are you? We'd like to know you as a race. And then all of a sudden you are bombarded with more deals than, say, a new store opening in Times Square, New York. I mean, it is just, you're overwhelmed, you know, and the Ferengi, they're just trying to basically cut you out of your percentage. And that's just not very nice at a first contact meeting.
I can see iPhone apps on Ferenginar and all the ads that would be in those apps. You'd barely be able to use the actual game or tool.
You would never be able to turn off the ads ever.
Well, see, that's what I was thinking at first, but Ferengi are always looking for a deal. So I think that there probably would be some amount you could pay to go ad-free.
I wonder if they accept like my Chase payment in gold pressed latinum, or do they actually like physical gold pressed latinum?
Well, we do see Quark transferring credits a lot, so I think maybe it doesn't have to be physical.
Okay, then I'm good, yeah. Because I don't really have a checkbook anymore. All my stuff is done digitally, so if the Ferengi want to do digital commerce with me, I'm all for that. Shake their hands. How you doing? First contact situation.
I wonder if they take Bitcoin.
I don't know. The Negus is pretty, he's a pretty flexible Ferengi. You know, he's hip. He's modern. Or his wives make him modern?
I think Boogie makes him modern.
Yeah.
All right. Well, there we go. Those are the results of the poll. And maybe for us, a little bit more of an examination of each alien species rather than just who we want to make first contact with. But let us know what you think about all these races. And of course, you can do that in the Babel Conference over on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field and you'll hop right in there. Click join and we'll let you right in. And then, of course, you can also contact us by email, trek.fm/contact. All right, Norm. Well, that's it for the news. So let's bring in Will and Philip and talk about that Klingon advocate who you mentioned a little bit earlier. After a number of run-ins with the Klingons during Enterprise's first two seasons, Captain Archer finally found himself in a place familiar to Star Trek fans, a Klingon courtroom. And I'm actually doing the air quotes there. Courtroom. Judgment takes us back to the ice caves of Ruapenthe, but it also does more than simply repeat the events of the undiscovered country. It also attempts to add some depth to Klingon society, and today we're going to discuss Archer's trial and maybe Targ meet a little bit as well. And to help us do that, we're joined from our Enterprise show, Warp 5, a cohort of Norm, and also content manager for the network, Will Wynn. Will, welcome back to the Ready Room.
Glad to be here. I just came to the decon chamber, so still wearing my blue skivvies. But, I mean, that's pretty much the par for the course for the NX-01.
Well, they're so comfortable. You want to just wear them all the time.
It's true. Space cotton is the best.
Plus, you never know when you're going to suddenly have time for a rubdown and you need to be ready.
That should be the new motto on our patch.
Ready for a rubdown. Time for a rubdown.
But in like a classy Latin.
Oh, it's too bad. I don't think anyone here speaks Latin, right? That would be awesome. Yes, time for a rubdown in Latin.
I'm writing it down right now. Don't worry about it, Chris.
I know a communications officer who could probably speak Latin.
But maybe. We probably won't use her.
Yeah, she may speak it, but we'll never know. They'll never let her. And as you can hear there from the voice, from our TNG show, Earl Grey, it's Philip Gilfus. Philip, welcome back.
Well, it's glad to be here. You know, I was running Commander Riker's NX-01 program, so it's pretty cool to play the chef. I did burn a few things, but it's a cool program, so I'm enjoying it's a little cramped, but it's a good program.
Very good. All right, so you guys wanted to talk about Judgment as we were picking an episode today, and Norm, I think you were the first person to throw Judgment out there, correct, as an option, saying that it's one of your favorite episodes of Enterprise. So why don't you give us a quick synopsis and then your initial thoughts here?
Well, Judgment has a really kind of spiritual connection to Star Trek VI, The Undiscovered Country. And just to summarize the plot very quickly for our listeners, Archer has been captured and is put on trial on a Klingon tribunal, very similar to what you've seen in Star Trek VI. In fact, almost all of the traditional touchstones, the pain sticks, the bird's eye view, overhead spotlight type of feel is there. The main prosecutor who has that giant staticky ball in the metal hand, you know, he's there. And a lot of Klingons just kind of stamping their feet and yelling things at him. You know, very akin to Star Trek VI. The only thing that was really missing, in my opinion, was a communications officer. But we will get to that later. Okay, so Archer's on trial. He is being charged with helping a colony escape the Klingon Empire, a colony that was pretty much left behind to die. And Archer, being the Archer that he is, he said, you know what, I'm going to intervene even if it's going to start a war of some kind based on Klingon law. And his advocate, played brilliantly by J.G. Hertzler as Kolos, he said, you know what, I have to defend you, but it doesn't really matter. And then Archer, through the course of the episode, tries to persuade him to say, you know what, it's time to take a stand and go back to what you believe is right, the Klingon sense of honor and justice. And through all of that, they prevail and get sent to Ruapenthe anyway. And end scene. So we can discuss that a little bit further. I didn't want to give it all away because we have some great stuff to literally mine from the caves of Ruapenthe in this episode. Literally.
Pun intended.
Wow. I can't believe Archer stayed there for like the next two seasons. I mean, we really would have thought they could have done more with that character than just keeping him in a mine. But
they kept him there literally for a full season. So season three starts like, yep, I'm still here.
And we don't know how long Kolos was there. We never find out anything about him. I know that in the novelization of The Expanse, Archer mentions that he's never heard from Kolos since that happened. And according to Memory Alpha, the current status of Kolos is that he is incarcerated at Ruapenthe. I have a feeling that he's probably dead at this point.
Current status, popsicle.
Okay. Unless you stick a pain stick on it, in which case I guess it would melt, right?
That probably is a Klingon popsicle. It's a pain stick that has a sort of frozen Targ meat on top of it. And so every time you take a bite, it actually sends an electric shock through you. That would be a good Klingon treat.
So now, does it have, like, would you buy a popsicle and let's say it's melon and it has like bits of fruit meat frozen into it? Does the Targ popsicle have pieces of Targ hair frozen into it?
I would think the good kind, because you know, when the vehicle comes down the street playing, you know, the Klingon opera to get all the kids to come up to it, and then the painstick popsicle is handed out, I think that would probably be it.
So there's like an ice cream truck on Rupinte.
Well, you know, for all the vegetarian Klingons that are out there, you can have the blood wine sickle if you want. You know, it has absolutely no meat to it.
But it's coming from an animal.
But it's coming from an animal, so I don't think that vegetarian Klingons...
Well, you're Klingon vegetarians. You know, this is the difference.
So they're more medium. Like
normal vegetarians.
Yeah, the blood of what? I think that question did was hung in the air during this episode. That's a good question, Archer.
That mystery of the episode.
That's a season 5 topic that we're going to have to discuss.
Chris, what was Manny Koto's explanation for where the blood wine came from?
I don't know. Let me open up Manny Koto's magic bag of hindsight.
We had a whole arc planned.
The Klingon blood wine arc in season 5.
It's a good arc.
How did Archer... Will, I mean, you just watched this pretty recently. How did Archer get captured? I still don't... You know, all of a sudden he's like, boom, I'm on trial.
Yeah, they never really explained that. I don't think it was actually very clear how it happened.
So then here's a question. Would you have wanted to see that in the episode, or do you like that it just opens with him on trial? Because personally...
I think the cold open works because...
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I don't really need that to be explained. And we know from other episodes that the Klingons use bounty hunters to find Archer again, with the Tellarite bounty hunter. So I figured, yeah, they probably did that, right? Or they probably had some sort of ambush or some sort of scheme to get him.
Well, what was happening was, in my opinion, that Archer was probably trying to get the colonists to a safer place, but he couldn't read the sign, stay away from Klingon borders.
Right.
And he would have been able to if he had his comms officer
only,
with him.
That was, what's her name? I didn't see her. So, you know, it was Smith.
How do you say underutilized in Japanese?
Hoshi Sato. Boom.
Travis Montgomery.
That's why you're wearing that Japanese shirt, Will, because you have all the translations for the show on your shirt.
But actually, just to go back to a point that you guys were talking about earlier, I mean, this is kind of out there, but going back to what ST-6 did with Colonel Worf and how he was supposedly an ancestor to Worf, is it plausible that Kolos is somehow a distant ancestor to Martok? The way he was talking about lost honor and was kind of a more blue-collar, had a more of a blue-collar background?
You know, well, he sure sounded a lot like Martok.
Sure sounded like, it's true. You're right. I don't know.
Wait. All Klingons sound alike. There. I don't want to be a part of this discussion.
I will say J.G. Hertzler plays the best Klingon, whether it's Martok, whether it's Kolos. He somehow gets, when we talk about adding depth to Klingons, somehow he understands the Klingon mentality, how to present a Klingon, but how to do it without it feeling like a caricature of this warrior alien. But there's more depth and thought to it.
Yeah, and I think when I was watching this episode, and of course, one thing that struck me is I'm currently doing a 24th century rewatch. So I started way back when with TNG. I know, Chris, you were figuring out how I was going to shoehorn that in. But then I'm in Voyager and DS9 right now. So it struck me. I haven't watched Enterprise in probably like a year and a half. And so I'm watching this episode and I'm thinking like, okay, so Enterprise, of course, you know, 22nd century humans and Vulcans and Andor and everything else. But like Klingons, I'm like, what do we really know about, like, you know, how Enterprise with the Vulcans and how they're different? And of course, humans are somewhat different, right? And Romulans, but like Klingons, like, are they that different? And should they be different? And like, what was Enterprise's and the writer's concept of, like, should we have like a pre-Klingon that we know and love? And so as I was watching this episode, I was thinking all about that. And then Kolos with his parents that were like, it's off the top of my head, so I'm going to get it wrong. Like a teacher,
a biologist.
Biologist, yeah. Which, of course, I mean, other than like a Klingon scientist in a certain series that I won't reference, you know, you usually don't see non-warriors. So I thought that was interesting. So I'm trying to think, like, is Enterprise trying to do this on purpose, that there was like a pre-Empire, or like what's going on? What are they trying to do? So
I think there's a hugely missed opportunity there, you know, because we are dialing it all the way back to the relationship between the Federation or the pre-Federation Starfleet, and Klingons when we saw that in Broken Bow, because Klingons are very stereotypical now. They're almost ubiquitous with what you think of the enemy of Star Trek. So I think the writers were probably thinking, hey, you know what? Everyone knows what Klingons are. We can just translate that to our series, and we don't really have to explain that away anymore because this is what it is. This is what Klingons are. And then you hear the lament in the voice of Kolos, and he's like, we were a great society once. I'm going to actually quote this because this is just so well done by JG, and I'm not going to do him nearly enough justice, but I think the sentiment is right. He said, we were a great society not so long ago when honor was earned through integrity and acts of true courage and not senseless bloodshed. That is a gold mine for writers to say, you know what? Let's show what happened. Why was there the rise of the warrior caste? There were all these different castes that built this incredible empire, the society that was built on all of these people, not just military, because you can't sustain a society. Obviously, we saw that in Star Trek VI, just through the military, because then your moon blows up, right?
Classic. So this is essentially a pitch for Klingon Game of Thrones, right? The clash of different houses, the clash of a more cynical outlook, a more militaristic outlook. I mean, I would watch the heck out of that show because there is a lot in Klingon mythology, you're right, Norm, that can be mined for a lot of narrative depth and not just the same type of Klingon archetype. And I think that's the burden of Enterprise. That's the sometimes the double-edged sword of Enterprise, is because it's at the tail end,
like the Batleth of the entire franchise.
What was that?
The Batleth of Enterprise, would you say?
It was the Batleth of the Enterprise, right? Yeah. Because at the tail end of that blade, right, it has the entire weight of what's come before it, but it has to go before everything, right? So it's walking this balance where it has to like be different, but not too different. And sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't. And I think this episode really walks on both sides of that line, because they're trying to do something different, but they're literally relying on the audience's memory of ST6, right, to carry it forward.
Well, Philip, I think that we saw Klingons and Enterprise 4 times before this, 4 episodes. And the last time we saw them before this episode was Marauders. And that's very much, you know, the group of Klingons come down, they're taking the resources from this planet, and they're just being the typical Klingons that we know. And I think that what Norm said, that, yeah, we're just going to translate what we know before to this new series, and we're not going to do much. In Broken Bow, I felt that the Klingons were sort of the weak point there, in that the way they start the episode with the Klingon, I think for Star Trek fans, they felt they needed that hook of something familiar. But when we get there to Kronos at the end of the episode, they're just the Klingons that we're accustomed to. It feels a little bit older. Like I think they did a nice job in the council chamber of making it feel like it was 200 years before what we had seen in TNG. But otherwise, they're just the same Klingons. I think it's only at this point David A. Goodman decided, why don't we try to add some depth to the Klingons and try to explain that, no, the society wasn't always like this. And then as we go later on through Enterprise, I don't know how you guys feel, but Will, what do you think? When we get to season 4 and we see Klingons a lot more, do you feel like we've just reverted back to, well, these are the Klingons that are always warriors? We do see a scientist, but...
Yeah, we do. And I think I'm actually a fan of that follow-up arc to the Augment arc, Affliction and Divergence. I think it's actually really good. I can't remember the actor's real name, but... The father from Uncle Phil from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air is
Schumer?
That Klingon.
Oh, yeah. Something like that. It's that SCH sound.
And he does such a great job in that role of, you know, he's this Klingon scientist, but he's also, you know, a military officer too. I think there is texture. I think if Enterprise, again, had been continued beyond season 4, you quite possibly could have seen that extension of the culture. But I think... if there is one thing to be said about how we saw the Klingons in Enterprise, it provides a sort of backdoor in-universe justification to what Picard said in First Contact, when he said, we had a disastrous first contact with the Klingons, and it led to decades of war. And if you look at the totality of the experiences that Archer and humanity had with the Klingons, for the most part, it's kind of dicey. Sure, they save the Klingons in a couple of times, but the other times, like in Marauders, in Judgment, and I think in Broken Bow when they return to Klang, it was always doing something to offend the Klingons, doing something, meddling in other affairs.
They're easily offended, Will.
They are easily offended, and I think it kind of provides justification for saying we got off to a really bad start, a really bad misunderstanding that didn't get resolved for decades, and it led to this Cold War and hostility. So in some ways, it makes sense when you look at it through that prism, but what we saw was kind of the same still.
Yeah, I mean, because it again, this episode made me wonder, and it could just be I'm writing my own story here, that, you know, it reminds me maybe of like the Cardassian story, right? Like before the military, you know, Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Or what they talk about anyway, that, you know, before the military took over, it was this entirely different people. And so then I'm almost wondering, like, do the Klingons we know and this whole like vein of philosophy, like, is that really the central tenet? Like, is that just a choice they made? Like, is this Kallus, you know, not religion, but for lack of a better word, you know, that belief and what that means, is that really like the central tenet, or is it just like a choice they made because they had these, you know, philosophers and scientists and all this stuff, and suddenly the warriors are like, well, this is what we believe, and now it's what everyone believes, and so like, well then what are the other Klingon beliefs that possibly could have won out as the culture developed?
Maybe it's just an interpretation of honor. So using the Cardassian example, the Cardassian example is collective good, right? It's very much a collective entity. The needs of the individual are subordinate to the needs of the family or the state. But how you define that can affect different outcomes. So when the Central Command says that means rampant militarism, when the Obsidian Order says that means strict control over every aspect of someone's lives, they're just distorting that code. I guess with the Klingons, you have the distortion of what is honor, right? So Kolos is saying honor used to mean something instead of just killing people and just claiming an empty victory. But the central concept is still there. It's how it's interpreted by, in this case, the warrior class. And Kolos is saying it's been distorted. That's how I would view it. But I mean, other people might view it differently.
Well, there's a certain kind of sense of like Klingon McCarthyism going on. I mean, if you spoke out against like the tenets of the government of this time, you could have just been locked away. I mean, you could have probably had really influential intellectuals that are rallying against the status quo, i.e. like the rebellion versus the empire. And once they find these pockets of resistance, you're locked away and you're never heard from again. That could have happened to Kolos's parents. We don't know. But you just hear the tone of his voice is just, there was a better time and there was a better empire and something happened. And Enterprise could have made that very pinnacle ticking point for the Klingon Empire as a story. It could have, like, all of a sudden, we need to go to war. There's some type of incursion that's happening. You have to change everything to the military, or else, like in season 3, like the Zindi, you have to change that mentality, or else we are going to lose everything. And they saw success in that. They saw that that model works. And 75% is military, 25% is everything else that supports the military. Success breeds success, probably, in their eyes, kapla. And they just went with it. And it became, again, like you said, Will, it became a distorted version of their own ethical code.
And this is sort of the cycle. I mean, I know we're going beyond this episode, but like that's sort of the cycle. Because if it's Star Trek VI, I mean, that was sort of a big point in Klingon history, where this cycle of being military, and then, as you say, I feel like this should be like jumping the shark, like blowing the moon is when your military society goes too far. Your moon blows
up.
That's
when you blow up the moon.
Exactly. And so, you know, and they sort of had to reset, and then, you know, peace. And then, of course, sort of peace for a while, you know, ups and downs. And then, of course, you had Deep Space Nine with Klingons go crazy spelled with a K, you know, there. And, you know, and then you go back and forth, and then the rise of Martok, blah, blah, blah. But so that you can't, it's not really sustainable. Sort of reminds me of like Mirror, like the Empire is not sustainable, you know. And so like in real life, I mean, like in world Star Trek, the Empire itself is not sustainable. So it goes through these ups and downs, where they just remember the good times.
You know, I thought that the writers did a really smart job in picking one particular part of the history where it could foreshadow the relationship between the Federation and the Klingon Empire in the 24th century, and that's using Rurapenthe as the staging ground for the story. I'm not Rear Pantheon, I'm sorry. Narendra 3.
Yeah.
Because that was the famous battle where the Enterprise C protected this colony, and the Klingons, it wasn't peacetime that they were talking, but it was ceasefire time. And because the Klingons value honor above everything else, well, at least there's that. At least that honor bridged the disarmament talks, if you will, between the Federation and the Klingon Empire, at least at that time.
I think in looking at our own world, what may have happened with the Klingon society is it could have just been a threat to security on Kronos itself from inside the overall global culture, or it could have been, since they are spacefaring, something coming from outside, but just a situation where more power was given to the warrior class, and then bit by bit, the warrior class took over and subdued everything, because that's what we see in our own world. And, you know, different societies handle it differently. Some societies are able to prevent that from completely taking over, but others aren't. But I don't know that there was any, not like a Zindi type thing, which you mentioned earlier, where something happens globally that requires like a true military response, even though at that point, Earth wasn't ready for a true military response. I don't get that feeling anyway. They have one ship that they can send out. But it would have been interesting if Enterprise had explored further what happened in the Empire later on down the road.
It reminds me that there's a parallel story that we talked about on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Where a certain actor who plays the prosecutor was in another certain series. And that was John Vickery, who played Nerun. And maybe not everyone's a Babylon 5 fan, but that was exactly the same story. The Minbari had the warrior class, the religious class, and the worker class, and the warrior class trying to take over. And so it's a very similar story. I think you could do that analogy for those who are B5 fans. And if you're not, you should be, about the Klingon.
Here, 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 here.
Yeah, I really need to watch Babylon 5. I need to get those discs from you, Norm.
Yeah, I do too. I've seen the first season and then I kind of fell out because it was difficult for me to get anything else here. I think now I can probably get them all. Well, let's talk about another element of this that we haven't really quite touched on yet, even though it's actually the first item on our outline. And Philip, let me ask you which TNG episode this reminds you of, because we have Duras in here. We're going back on the timeline and we're setting up the entire Duras family, ultimately, who causes all kinds of havoc for everyone. You know, to this day, Troy still insists that it's the Duras' fault. It's the Duras family's fault that the Enterprise crashed in the first place.
That's right. I think they just must have like a bastard gene. Like that just must be in that family.
Bastard gene.
Yeah.
Now, there's your show title, Phil.
Yeah, because I mean, like they're all jerks. There's not a there's rotten targ meat in the whole family tree. You know, I mean, you got this. You have a captain. Excuse me, weapons officer Duras.
Weapons officer.
Yeah. Who can't captain his way out of a whatever? But like you know. He's the worst witness. Okay, and then you have Duras, who, you know, gets killed by Worf in like 2 seconds. Then you have the sisters, who are actually probably the decent one. Maybe it's just the women just have the smarts in this family. But of course, they're dumb enough to attack a Galaxy-class starship and a 20-year-old rebuild bird of prey. So they get killed. And then you have the literally the bastard son. And he gets... I saw that Deep Space Nine episode recently and I forgot about it, but I know he gets kind of smacked around for a while too. So anyway, yeah, they're just a horrible family. They're like, you know, like I'm trying to think of like what it would look like in Kronos, that they're sort of like their bird of prey is like on concrete blocks in their front yard. Like they're just terrible.
They're like 20 targs living underneath the deck.
Exactly.
I hate to put it this way, but maybe in some strange twisted logical sense, if Archer just kind of flew on by and didn't help the colonists, the Enterprise D would have never crash landed on Viridian 3.
So it's not Troy's fault. It's Captain Archer's fault.
It's Captain Archer's fault, yes.
That's right.
So everyone...
That's the case against Archer.
Give Troy a rest. It's Archer's fault that the Enterprise crashes in Generations.
Just, I mean, you know, we love... wibbly wobbly timey wimeyness of Star Trek. You know, we all do.
Everything's connected. But I think to answer your point, Chris, I think it's indicative of like the small universe syndrome that a lot of long running franchises go through. And sometimes it's a good thing. Sometimes it's a bad thing. And I'm ambivalent about this. Sometimes it bothers me when I think about like, yeah, that's a pretty small universe that it's the same family, right? In the same way that, oh, Darth Vader built C-3PO. It's the same guy. They're on the same planet. They're all related somehow, right? But I think this, it's okay for me because I don't think they really hammer the fact that it is Duras. I think they move beyond it quickly enough for me to not to dwell on it so much. But when you take it apart, yeah, I mean, ostensibly them mentioning this means that they're the same family that have been, you know, been rabble rousing for you know, two centuries. And you would expect that there would be another family that might want to do some nefarious things. Why does it always have to be, you know, that same family?
Well, I think that I'm with you on the small universe syndrome thing, and it's one of the problems I have with the novels. And the more recent novels have gotten better about it, I think. But if you go through Star Trek novels over the years, you get a whole lot of that. Like, all these characters seem to know each other, and they all end up on the same ship together. And in the case of the Duras family here, though, because they're going to set up the Klingons to be, or they have set them up over the years to be, based a lot on sort of traditional Japanese culture and the way that the family lines and the houses run through here as well. And in that case, you do have some very influential families that go back centuries, even, you know, 1,000 years. So I can see that there could be a family like this, the Duras family, that is very influential in Klingon politics and does run through, certainly through, a 200-year time period like we see in Star Trek. So I think that of all the things that they did here with the trial echoing the Undiscovered Country and Rapinthe, I think throwing Duras in there was one of the more palatable things that did make sense on the timeline for me.
Yeah, because again, being sort of not a newbie, but sort of not having seen Enterprise for a while and watching this episode, it's like I knew it was an early episode because I'm one of those season 1-2 fans. And watching,
could you tell by Archer's hair that it was a little bit longer?
Well, I was actually going to say everyone's hair seems short to me, like T'Pol and Archer, like everyone just seemed like, I'm like, I know it gets like an inch longer every season, but it just like struck me that this almost has like, you could make this a season 4. I mean, maybe not by the character, but like the season 4 episode by how fan callbacks it was. Like y'all said, I don't think it was distracting, but it was like, if you added one more thing, it would be too much. Like, you have, because you have like Martok playing Martok, and you have like Duras and Duras, and then you have, you know, the Star Trek 6 set up, and then you have sort of the trial itself, which not only Star Trek 6 seems like almost every other trial episode I've ever seen of Star Trek. And so it was kind of like, okay, guys, you know, don't be afraid to be original here.
Well, how about this? How about if when Archer is there on trial, we were talking on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
About whether or not Archer should have been able to understand anything that's going on. Should he have had a communicator? Well, what if they not only gave him a communicator device, but what if at some point, let's say Hoshi is there and the magistrate says something, Archer looks confused, he looks over at Hoshi, and she pulls out a dictionary and she starts flipping through the dictionary to find just the right word for him.
And then the prosecutor says, don't wait for the translation. Answer now.
Right.
Basically, I mean, Norm made a point in the Babel conference. It was Brittany Jones, actually. She made a point in the Babel conference, and Norm chimed in and I chimed in too. And this is a perfect example of, this is an opportunity that could have been crafted more perfectly for a communications or diplomatic officer to act as that bridge, right? Before there actually was a device that Kirk and McCoy use in SD6, they needed literally a translator. Could have been Hoshi, could have been a Klingon translator, anything to be that bridge. Ideally, it should have been Hoshi because of, you know, how she should be integral to many of these episodes. But the fact that, you know, you didn't have that, you just had them conversing. I think for me, I forgot about that for a long time because the acting between Scott Bakula and John Hurster was so good, the rapport was so good that you just instantly forgot that, yeah, why are they understanding each other, right? But now when I remembered it and looking back at it, you know, it irritates me because these are just one of those opportunities where they just didn't bother to expand the characters that they had when they really could have just pushed them forward. And Hoshi is a prime example of that.
Yeah, I mean, there are so many different ways that you can slice that because they've done it in TV before this episode and certainly after this episode with language. And language informs culture. And it would have been really interesting if something was just so poorly translated because either Hoshi freaked out or the translator wasn't working that it just led to centuries of this really ridiculous misunderstanding between the Federation and the Klingon Empire. Because it started like that. It reminds me of, and this is kind of like a little bit of a serious historical note, it reminds me of the Treaty of Waitangi in New Zealand, where the British, they came in and they asked the native Maori leaders at the time to sign a contract that they couldn't read. They basically handed over most of their native lands for like a handful of magic beans. And because there was no translator there, so the history is being unraveled right now, but could you imagine that being seen at this time? I mean, the writing potential is enormous.
I mean, I could see it that Hoshi mixes up guilty and not guilty, and that could probably... By the way, my favorite, and there's no way to squeeze this in, so I'm just have to do it now. My favorite part, just because, like, it's so melodramatic. I mean, it's not bad, but I'm just like, yeah, it's a little... Like, where it's like... I agree. My client is guilty.
Right. And when he says does he snap his suspenders and says, "Well, I'm no big city lawyer, but I think he's
I
not
might
guilty.
Just be a caveman, unfrozen caveman lawyer, but even I know that he was just an annoyance. He didn't really mean anything."
You know, then John Vickery should have taken over and just completely crossed over to Babylon 5, Philip, and said, like, "My heart is no longer warrior. It is religious." And the Starfire wheel takes him.
Right. The biggest pain stick of amazing. All.
But I can see with this problem of translation that in the Undiscovered Country, the Kittimer Accords, that was actually a meeting of linguists from the Federation and the Klingon Empire. And they finally resolved the proper translation and everything was okay after that.
That's true, actually. But you know, the perfect example of how language is so important is in the very beginning. Just think about the very setup between the contrasting stories, right? When Duras is saying, you know, they attacked us first, and Archer said, you know, that didn't happen. What if the initial, you know, event that tied everything together was a misunderstanding of what the refugees were, right? She translated the Klingon to mean refugees that are, you know, that need humanitarian aid, but she somehow missed another crucial component of saying that they're political refugees or that they're rebels or that they're rebels that need humanitarian assistance. But then she only captured the need humanitarian assistance. So Archer, thinking that he's helping and doing, you know, a good deed, is inadvertently stepping into a situation that's much more complicated just because they don't understand the complexity of the situation. I mean, they allude to not understanding the situation, but they could have really illustrated it by having someone literally not understanding the language.
And by someone, you mean the communications officer whose name appears in the opening credits.
Yes.
Yeoman?
Not really in the
Yeoman
episode.
Yeoman Rand? Is that? I'm still blanking. It's going to come to me.
Yeah, it's been a long road translating from there to here.
Oh, that's true.
You know, so.
Well, let's talk about Ruapinte a little bit. And I remember the first time that this episode came on, feeling a bit like, okay, so we're going to do this. We're going to have a Klingon trial. We're going to go to Ruapinte, just like the Undiscovered Country. I think it's an episode that was very familiar to Star Trek fans. But for me, it also felt coming in season two, because they're doing such different stuff on Enterprise most of the time. And then suddenly here's this thing that's just ripped right out of the Undiscovered Country. Felt a little bit like a creative crutch to me at the time. Now, when I watch it now, it doesn't bother me as much because I'm really caught up in the conversation between Archer and Kolos. And I really like what they're trying to do here with the Klingons and the message of the episode. And it is kind of fun to think about the fact that we're rolling back on the timeline to the 22nd century, and here's the moment that results in centuries of conflict between the Klingons and the humans. But nevertheless, it is very much ripped right out of the Undiscovered Country. So, Norm, I know that you really loved this episode. You brought it into the fold here for discussion today. Did you ever feel that way when you saw it?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I can forgive a lot when it comes to watching the show, but if you had to ask me, you know, honestly, do you think that this was in some way just lazy writing? I think it was. But at the same time, I think the writers had their hands cuffed a little bit when the network says, we need you to do something in this episode that brings in new viewers, that viewers can identify with pretty quickly and without a lot of setup. So, sure, you have Klingons, trial room, pain sticks, anger, you know, litigators that don't listen to you, sentence Rurapenthe, and build something in there aside from that, a really nice character study between two actors. That sounds like a good show. You know, I heard like a lot of people kind of like collectively groan, I think, when Rurapenthe was shown on TV. But at the same time, why not? Because it is part of Klingon culture. Like we were talking about this before. It's why not the Duras family? It just because they're using it now doesn't mean it hasn't existed for centuries as their penal colony. Yeah. I don't know. It's hard to say. I'm pro and against it because I'm pro for it because it identifies something quickly from a writing standpoint. I'm against it because you have an opportunity to create something new and something for the fabric of Enterprise that hasn't been seen yet. So I'm not sure if the writers had that kind of leeway or flexibility sometimes when they had to submit scripts.
Norm, I almost feel like for this episode, if we could put your words, we would paraphrase Robert Kennedy that some people look at this episode and ask why. You look at this episode and ask, why not?
Why not? No, believe me, I've had many discussions about using the standard tried and true and tropey measures of how do we make Enterprise palatable to a very exhausted fan base. Maybe this is one of those reasons. Maybe this is one of those examples. I don't find it egregiously horrible, but at the same time, you could have probably used Hoshi in a more creative way and helped explain away not using Rurapenthe by some type of really awesome endgame translation that she, hey, I figured it out. I didn't need to use a dictionary because I was in the room. You know, it was authentic Klingon vocabulary that was being used and won the day. Who knows?
So in Friends, comes back to Hoshi.
In Friends titles, is this episode called the one that doesn't have Hoshi in it?
So pretty much Enterprise.
That's most of the series, yeah.
Buzzing.
So Norm would like it to be called the one where Hoshi figures it out at the last minute.
She is my Scooby-Doo team. He goes, we would have gotten away with it if it weren't for Hoshi and her darn universal translator.
So she goes up and rips the mask off the prosecutor.
Oh my God, it's prosecutor so-and-so.
It's old Mr. McGregor from up on the hill.
Yeah. Darn you kids. And I would have gotten away with it too if it wasn't for that darn targ meat.
And what happens is that
the hair gave it away. It was fake hair.
And right. Then like Reed and Tucker are like eating a snack right in behind them, and I can see.
And then we find out that what happened is that when Archer was a kid, he and his friends used to sneak up and steal fruit from the trees in Mr. McGregor's yard up on the hill.
Yeah.
And ever since then, Mr. McGregor's been, one of these days, I'm going to get you kids.
And then you see Trip and Porthos kind of pulling up the rear, you know, having a couple of snacks.
Would you like a Porthos snack?
Yeah. Yeah. Oh my God, does that make Shuttle Pod 1 the mystery mission?
Trip would be Shaggy. Let's all be honest. He would be the Shaggy.
That's true.
Character.
He would be Shaggy. Yeah.
He'd be
like Porthos, let's go get the whiskey.
Soinks.
So now I'm having a hard part thinking of who Velma is, because there's not many to choose from left here.
I think T'Pol would be Velma.
No, well, that's yeah, Daphne then. I mean, Who would be saying Jinkies?
Oh, Daphne. Maybe Cutler could be Daphne.
Well, there you go. Way to get in Cutler in the show, Chris.
That's right.
He goes, check mark. Well done.
Now I'm picturing Archer with an ascot.
Freddy's hair never changed, though. That's you know, true. At least we don't know which season Freddy's
That's
in.
That's true.
You know,
he never had to face those hard choices.
No.
So yeah, I'm with you, Norm, on this. Really, that I'm kind of mixed on it. Like it, I understand they want to bring in new viewers, and they can tie it in, and it makes sense that Rorapinthe's been around. If you think, they say in Star Trek VI, it's known around the galaxy as the alien's graveyard. Obviously, if it's that well known, it's got to be around for a pretty long time. So it all makes sense. But at the same time, it does sort of feel like, okay, let's just grab some stuff that's really familiar. But thankfully, they did write this great conversation between Archer and Kolos that takes place in the cell and really feels like a stage play. You know, I can see that on the stage with the lights turned down, with the torches on the side, and that lighting being very natural. And you really do feel there like J.G. Hertzler and Scott Bakula are on the stage just delivering this great dialogue. It doesn't feel like a TV show for me at that point.
It harkened back a lot for me to the end of Mirror, Mirror.
Yeah.
You know, when Kirk said, you know, in every revolution, there's one man with a vision. I felt that that's the same kind of gravitas that Archer's last line had and Kolos' last line had, where Kolos was like, I can't restore honor to my people if I leave. And yes, we probably can Wikipedia, you know, the future of Kolos and find out what happened in the novels. But man, J.G. Hertzler just sells the end of that episode. And I think that's why it sticks with me, because his performance alone carries this whole episode for me.
Definitely.
And it speaks volumes that he did this with two Klingon characters when he was so known for another Klingon character. The fact that he was able to do it in a much different way, but still, and in one episode, and still have such an impact while playing a Klingon character, I think says so much about the range that he has, that he can translate into ostensibly two very, at least aesthetically, similar characters. I think says a lot about him as an actor.
I still see a lot of Martok in the expressions, but it's different enough that it comes off as a different character. But maybe that's why earlier on we asked, could it be that Kolos is a distant ancestor of Martok? And therefore,
yeah, that would be like that would be literally the straw that would break the camel's back. That would be so just like the universe is so small, literally I can fit it in my hand. That's how small this universe is.
Maybe it can be like George Lucas would do with Star Wars. When DS9 comes out on Blu-ray, they will insert a line where Martok is talking to Sisko and he mentions, you know, my great-great-grandfather Kolos once defended Captain Archer.
Martok fired first? Is that what we're saying? You know?
Well,
oh, God, that'd be awful. That'd be so egregiously awful.
And he opens up a picture book and there he is.
And it's like Archer. Archer just has a picture of just Archer there and like, oh, there it is. There it is.
Well, you guys didn't get the remade Generations Blu-ray where the instead of the William Shatner Kirk's ghost, you get the Chris Pine Kirk's ghost. You guys didn't get that one?
Yeah.
Oh. I missed that one. I'll have to download that later.
Well, you know, you guys were talking about the ending. I struggled with it. Because just with Rorapinthe being what it is, certainly, I just don't see how that's ever a choice to stay there. I mean, like, it's one of those things, like, sounds good, but then you think about, like, freedom? Rorapinthe. And, like, I mean, yes, it's a principled stand, and he certainly sells it well, but, like, what's he going to do other than die? Like, how...
Well, he knows he's there for 1 year, so he figures, I can survive, I can get out, but I think that when Kolos talks through the episode about how the judicial system used to be based on honor as well, I think for him, the honorable thing to do is to stay there and survive and then go back and then try to effect some kind of change. But I think the honor part is why he would make the decision to stay there, if he really believes what he was saying to Archer.
Yeah, the way I read it, the subtext beneath the desire to reform the system was also penance, because he was saying, I've been doing this for 50 years, and then for 20 years, I've basically let them just convict anyone that they wanted. I didn't really do my job. So I think, yeah, he does want to escape, but there's also a part of him that feels that this is his punishment.
Yeah, I agree.
He has to stay here because he just, for 20 years, he just let this happen. So this is literally the least that he could do, that he could live with himself in that way.
Yeah. I mean, there's also kind of like this, not as heavy, but there's this Mandela-esque subtext to what he's doing. You know, he wants to say, you know, I'm going to serve my time to prove the point that my time was in my incarcerated time was wrong, but I'm going to be able to show you through strength and honor that I can overcome this and probably be that ideal that may spark a little bit of a change in the Klingon mentality. Obviously, you know, when we go past 2151 and into the 24th century, that really probably wasn't true.
Right. Yeah. He was not able to change anything. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he doesn't, at least he didn't go into like an I Have a Dream speech or something like that.
Is that, and I'll ask y'all, I mean, being the you know, the Warp 5 guys, do you think that's a challenge for Enterprise? In other words, you know, this episode ends on a hopeful note, and then you're like, oh, wait, it doesn't happen, because we know it doesn't happen. You know, is that a struggle for certain storylines to end on hopeful notes or ambiguous notes when you're like, wait a minute, I know what's going to happen. Why am I letting them making me think that, like, there's a mystery?
Well, I think it is when they go with something as obvious as this. Like, they are locked in. They can't really do anything to change what we know happens with Klingon society down the road. That's where I like it, when they create new material, but they find clever ways to tie it into the timeline, but then they're not as locked into what has come later.
But it's also nice seeing the attempt, because at least there was the possibility of the Klingons turning it around at some point, and it just didn't work. But a character like that, I think the reason why Kolos is such a good character is because he tried and he made the attempt and it was still unsuccessful, which means that deep down, ingrained in Klingon society now, is the inability to change, no matter how strong the inspiration is against the status quo. So I think it informs it a little bit. It could have paid off probably a little bit more if we had subsequent seasons, but that is our motto on Warp 5, the what if and the possibilities show. So, I mean, we can do that until the cows come home or until the target comes
home. But we could have a later, like, someone could fill in, it probably wouldn't be on television, but at some point you could fill in, like, in the early 23rd century or something, there's this period of time where things get better and then the warrior class takes over again. So it does open up a possibility for more storytelling.
That was the heady times of the Romulan Alliance.
The D7 exchange.
Yes.
Sure. You know, we were talking about it on the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
You know, what this episode does is it's a very clever lampshade, because for so long in Trekdom, in the fandom, we've talked about how Klingons are so one-dimensional, so archetypical. How can a society literally be built on, you know, warriors or space Vikings that just headbutt each other all the time? Like, how does a society function? And this is a very clever way to do it in one episode, to say there are other elements there. It's just that this warrior caste subsumes everything else. But there are scientists, teachers, farmers, merchants. They're there. It's not literally just one warrior class. It's maybe a warrior culture that pervades. But it's a very clever way of saying we understand how perhaps the success of the TNG era Klingon became too successful, really, right? It became too successful and they just couldn't break from that mold. So I think it was very clever and it added value to the larger universe in this episode and what they did in acknowledging other classes.
Well, I'd like to ask all of you guys a question. I mean, when it comes to Klingon characters, which characters resonate, do you think, most successfully as Klingons? For me, you have Kolos, you have Martok, you have Chancellor Gorkon, because for me, I thought that these were the Klingons that the Klingons should have been overall in all the series. When you go all the way back to the original series, Commander Kor, thinking man's Klingon, very devious. Kang, another one, thinking man's Klingon, very devious. So you had, well, and you have, you know, Koloth, but that was a fun episode. But they were all very intelligent people. They weren't the headbutting types that you generally saw later on in the series. So why not try and steer it around back to those types of Klingons, maybe in future episodes or future series, if we ever get them.
I think it depends on what you like about the Klingons. So for me, I pretty much agree with what you say. That's what I think of. Martok is my favorite Klingon, and these are the types of Klingons that resonate with me. Though I think with a lot of fans who love Klingons, I think Gowron, Lursa, Bator, these types of Klingons, you know, Duras, they resonate well because it's just the, hey, we're badass warriors. We're going to fight with our batlets. I think a lot of people identify with that because it's action-packed and it's exciting. But for me, that's not very interesting. That's why I'm not going to say I skip Klingon episodes, but if I'm going to choose a random episode to watch, I will rarely choose an episode that features Klingons because they're not that interesting to me as a race. They were early on, but I kind of got tired of it over time.
I mean, to me, the power of the Klingons is the metaphor or the analogy that they represent. Like you said, Kang and Kor, and there were actually, you know, several other Klingons in TOS as well. Private Little War, all those, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, sure.
The power of that analogy, of course, being maybe not literally the Soviet Union, but at least the perception of the Soviet Union in TOS. And in TNG, I would argue that remains because those, you know, in Heart of Glory, not the best episode, but in Heart of Glory, you see sort of the, I don't know, depressed Klingon Empire because there it's like the alliance, like, well, we're aligned with the Federation, you know, we're all peace and happy and longing for happier days, which, you know, very Russian Federation. And then certainly one could argue, if it's still keeping with the Russian Federation theme, in Deep Space Nine, of the Klingons going on the attack and being offensive and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, to me, that the power is not just in and of themselves the created Klingons, it's what is the metaphor, what's the analogy, it doesn't always have to be the Russians, that they represent. So as long as they're sort of representing something other than themselves, to me that's the power of Klingons.
Okay, well, last quick point, which we've touched on here and there, but we didn't really go in depth into it, is why is Archer on trial in the first place? We did talk about that we didn't see him get captured, we just have this cold open and he's there on trial. And did the Klingons just have it out for him? At this point, he's had several run-ins with them, but apparently, as we saw with the prosecutor, a lot of them don't even know that he came and he helped foil the Suliban plot of trying to, I guess, was it ultimately Future Guy's plot, I would assume, to get the Klingon Empire in turmoil.
You can just say Picard, Chris, it's fine.
Well, you know, if Archer is Future Guy, well, man, that explains it all. That's why they're after him. That's why they have it out for him. But why is Archer on trial here? Did any of you guys wonder that? Or did you just assume that the Klingons don't like the humans after the few run-ins they've had, and so now they're going to go and go after Archer?
I was so confused because, and it's fine, but it's when they're telling the story, the prosecutor and the magistrate and everyone, of like, these are all the horrible things Archer did. He engaged you in battle. Like, that's what you would do. Like, everything.
That's what you want.
Everything they said he did, I'm like, that's what you do. That, like, you're, right. You're accusing him of being a Klingon, basically. Like, you're helping out these rebels who can't.
So they're jealous of Archer because he does what they do.
I mean, he doesn't really have that many ridges, so I don't know why.
But he has better hair.
Yeah. And like, the rebels who can't eat and are starving and dying, like, I mean, I that's a pretext. Like, to me, Chris, it would explain it that there's a pretext, but then, like you said, they sort of pop that balloon and they're like, oh, wait a minute, we didn't remember all this other stuff until you just brought it up. Then what's the pretext? I was very confused.
And all this stuff just happened for them, like, last year. Right? Archer coming there with the blood sample, Archer helping pull the Klingon ship out of the atmosphere of the planet and sleeping dogs. But nope, no one knows about it.
They have a horrible media system on Kronos. It's really just all about the entertainers. What's the latest opera singer, you know, drunk on blood wine doing? It's not a lot of substance. It's
so you're
sad,
saying
really.
That the entertainer class, they have a good life.
Yeah, it's just what the latest young Klingon is singing and, you know.
But no, actually, I mean, given the society, it probably would be like China, North Korea type situation where the media is completely controlled by the warrior class and controlled by the government. And so, yeah, news of these things would never get out. But you would still expect that the prosecutor would have access to some of those records of interactions that the Empire has had with the person who he's prosecuting.
Well, I think the whole thing was, to Colas's point, was that this trial was more spectacle than substance.
Well, yeah, of course.
You know, you had a captain whose pride has been wounded, a captain of the Klingon Empire, who got beaten by a human ship. You got to be kidding me, right?
I think that's the challenge of Enterprise and still trying to wrap everything up in a lean 45 minutes, right? So if this had been expanded into 3 episodes, you could have seen the motivations. Maybe Duras was embarrassed, or they had another agenda to embarrass Earth Starfleet, that they had other designs that made the trial make more sense. And I think so much of season 2 and even season 1, you have really good concepts, but because it needs to be wrapped up by the end of this episode, it just is really rushed, right? And to Philip's point, at the ending too, right, you kind of feel like, Reed's here all of a sudden, and they was able to bribe everyone in very effectively and just get a ship on a dilithium barge and just, it was just so like, we're out of here, right? And that's just because they literally have to end this episode, right? But if you had, a 3-part arc where you had a beginning and an end, and this trial was in the beginning, you could really see the motivations and like the actual how everything plays out if it was actually laid out and had a foundation.
Well, I'm glad they resisted the urge to make it action-packed and spend a lot of time on the rescue attempt, which they could have done, right? Yeah. So in this case, I am glad that it just ends that way and it's quickly wrapped up, and you just have to accept the fact that, well, they were working on a plan and they got him out, and they instead used the airtime for the actual exploration of the society.
I think if you dial it all the way back to behind the writer's curtain, a bunch of guys that know their stuff, they were like, you know what? Wouldn't it be really cool if, and then they all kind of put it all together and they're like, you know, I love Star Trek VI. It's my favorite film. Wouldn't it be cool if? It's like, well, I really loved yesterday's Enterprise. That's my favorite episode of Star Trek The Next Generation ever. Wouldn't it be cool if? And all of a sudden, I really love Targ meat. Wouldn't it be cool if?
I really want to see Targ hair on that thing.
Are you saying this is the fanfic of season 2? Is that this is what's going on?
That's what it feels like. It feels like this is a Valentine to a long time.
Oh, how dare you?
But it works so much better than the actual Valentine that was supposed to actually be the one.
Why can't it be like the Arbor Day of?
But you know what I mean? Like it. These continuity points actually work. I mean, yeah, you know, it's a pretty heavy-handed nod at times, but at least this episode adds something new to all of that previous material, which makes it works, you know, unlike, you know, These Are the Voyages, in my opinion. I think something like this, you know, there's a lot that's familiar, but they're adding something new in the end, which makes it, on balance, redeemable. So.
And y'all talked about the spectacle of the trial. And again, I know this is like, you know, this is stupid, but I'm going to go ahead and do it. So the whole like courtroom thing, I like, it's like, man, I'm glad they're not the jury. They're not the jury. Then who the heck are they? Who are these people that are coming in with sticks that I guess you just get when you walk in the building and bang down and grumble? Like who, like, it's to me.
Well, they're obviously not on fire.
Like, to me, it's just like the trope, like having been in a courtroom as an attorney several times, nobody ever grumbles in real life. And so it's like every 5 seconds, bang, 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 bang. I'm like,
all I know is that I would have gone to law school, Philip, if I knew that's what a courtroom would be like. Would be like, you get to be over there with these sticks and you get to go like this every time someone speaks. And the judge has like this
sparkle
Sauron type orb that he just hits and there's sparks come out. I mean, that's way better than a gavel. Like, obviously, if that was what like the courtroom was, like, clearly I would have been, you know, a lawyer. Clearly.
I know what it is, Philip. All of those people standing on the sides banging the sticks, those are all the Klingon law students that couldn't pass the bar.
Oh, wow. But what are the sticks for? I don't, like, it's not a pain, or is it a pain stick? Because if anyone watches this episode, which we do not encourage irresponsible behavior, but if you do a drinking game every time a pain stick is used in this episode, you will be dead. Okay.
Blood wine, though, only.
Well, only
please.
A flask. Yeah. They only drink it in flask form in the 22nd century.
And we don't know whose blood it is. That doesn't matter at all. It's hopefully not
I'll explain blood. Later, as Doctor Who would say.
All right. Well, let's wrap up the discussion here with our final thoughts and our rating. So, Will, what are your final thoughts on the episode and what rating do you give this?
So I would give this 4 out of 5 Targ hooves that had the little black hairs on them.
Oh.
You know, I think I understand where a lot of people are coming from, and I understand where you're coming from too, Chris, in terms of kind of using a lot of what has come before as a type of crutch, and I definitely do see that. But I think, and especially the communicator thing, the fact that they're, you know, they could just understand each other, that bothers me the more and more I think about it. But on balance, the episode is really just saved by just the terrific, terrific performance of John Hertzler and how he sells Kolos, the conversation he has with Archer, and what that means to the larger universe, what it means to Klingon society. It still just adds so much to it that I can forgive the very familiar setting, and it's still a very enjoyable episode to pop in to watch just because the performances are so good. So still 4 out of 5 for me.
How about you, Philip?
Yeah, I mean, I did enjoy this episode, and like you Chris and the guys here have said that it does add a lot to the Klingons, you know, what we know or what we think we know. Though I wish for once we would get an alien courtroom that is not like worse than humans. Like, it's such human arrogance. Like, it's a tribunal. It's this episode's like, oh, humans have the best court system. Everyone else sucks. But anyway, jingoism rules, I guess. But overall, I enjoy this, and I'm going to give it 6 out of 8 missing and deleted Hoshi scenes.
How about you, Norm?
Well, since I brought it up, I guess I'll try and have to defend it in my final analysis. But I do love this episode very much because of what Will said. J.G. Hertzler just sells me. And this was even before I knew... Gosh, I hope I don't get slapped for this one by the fans. This is before I knew who Martok was.
Oh.
Because I'm not the most well-versed Deep Space Nine viewer. And it wasn't because of his voice, and it wasn't because of who J.G. Hertzler is. It's because of what he brought to a Klingon character. He brought insight and dimension and texture and logic and an educated stance on what it means to be part of this culture. That's what draws me into this episode every single time I watch it, because it's not action when it comes to a Klingon mm-hmm. character. It is inaction, really. That allows you to understand how the culture has weighed on him and how much he laments better days. So for this, I'm going to rate this 8 out of 10 unopened Klingon law books.
All right. Well, I don't really have much to add to what you guys have said, because you've said pretty much everything that I feel about it. Again, in watching it to prepare for this, I really get into the dialogue. And I do like what David A. Goodman is trying to do here. I wish they could have followed up on it more in the series. And the initial reaction I had to the use of the Star Trek VI wrappings, it's fine. I mean, I enjoy it. I love Star Trek VI, which might be one reason why I kind of groaned the first time this came on, because Star Trek VI is one of my favorite of all the films. And seeing them use it here, it feels out of place. And I still think this episode feels out of place in Enterprise, and especially in season 2, because of that connection. But it's still a good episode, and J.G. Hertzler just really gives a wonderful performance here. So I'm going to give this episode 8 pieces of blood wine braised Kobe Wagyu targ.
Ooh, that's like some gourmet style targ right there.
It's really gourmet. Yeah.
Can you get that at
the DS9?
Topped
off with a garnish of hair.
Can you get that at the DS9 restaurant?
No, they can't get
that. You can get it at the Klingon restaurant. There's a Klingon restaurant on Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, that guy, he likes to serve food that's been sitting around a little bit too long.
He's not a good targ monger, from what I've heard. You know, so. You can get it at Quark's.
Wait.
At a very reasonable price.
Are you saying
he,
like, he serves like sort of like the Taco Bell, like the American Mexican food? So it's like the Federationalized Klingon food is what you can get on Deep Space Nine.
We have Wagyu targ, and they also have your run of the mill ground targ. So you know, don't, goes into your sausage.
Well,
don't
you ask what's in the tart. I mean, he did try to serve some basically spoiled gawk to Bashir and Melora. And Melora called him out on it. And then he gave him the good stuff. So he has good stuff at the Klingon restaurant on the promenade, but only if you know to ask for it. It's kind of like the secret menu.
He's getting all his business acumen from Quark. Really maximizing those profits, huh?
I like how the Starfleet Bajorans have been eating the spoiled stuff and thinking like, oh, it's quality Klingon food.
Right.
Great stuff.
There should be a YouTube video. It says, Klingons try Federation Klingon food for the first time.
Filipinos on board would be like, what? No, that's fine.
All right. So before we go, we'll tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs.
Well, you can find me every week on Warp 5 with Norman and Tommy, where we're just talking everything Enterprise. And you can also find me in the Babel Conference, of course, which is our dedicated Facebook listeners group. And then you can also tweet me at will_win, spelled NGUYEN. And since I'm the content manager for the network, if you have any ideas on, you know, what we talk about or what we have talked about, just shoot me a line.
Excellent. Yeah. Thanks for all your work on that too, Will. And Philip, tell everyone where they can find you around the interwebs, around the network, and around stages in the North Carolina area.
They can find me here on the network each and every single week without fail, talking all things Next Generation, which I may have brought up once or twice here on this episode, along with my fantastic co-hosts, Daniel Prue and Darren Moser, there on Earl Grey. They can find me on Twitter at NC Public Servant. That's NC for North Carolina. And again, I'm also in the Babel Conference, especially if you mention hashtag Bridgemates. And I didn't want to do this in front of everyone, but I will say, Team Free Enterprise has thrown down the gauntlet to Warp 5. I'm just going to say that. I'm going to walk away from the mic.
Them's fighting words, Norm. We gotta saddle up.
We already have our team shirts, Will, as you know. We have our Team Sriracha shirts, so.
We do.
We already have one up on you guys.
Well, we already have one up, Dan, so.
We will take that challenge at some point in the future for sure.
But I know that on the NX-01 they have it better because I'm sure that Chef cooks with actual sriracha. But on the Enterprise D, that stuff's replicated.
And on the Klingon restaurant?
No, it's spoiled.
It's just, you know, it's spoiled. Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining us today, guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you.
Chris, it's been absolutely a blast talking about Judgment from Enterprise today. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on Trek FM this past week. So here's a quick look at some of the other things you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Set this movie at the end of the 5-year mission. Skip ahead 5 years. You know, kind of like Dark Knight or whatever. And then say, okay, we've had all these adventures, blah, 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 blah. And now we're at the end. We're about to go home. You know, and it's been, a fun time was had by all.
Earl Grey.
Again, you know, because it's January, my ship was shot beyond the bounds of normal interstellar travel to the center of the galaxy. But we were back in time for tea.
The Orb.
They're not even thinking about it at this point. Okay, how do we start the resistance? Yeah. How do we do all this? Yeah. Because they have become comfortable with where they are and thinking that they're doing all they can. And yet we know, as the audience, that they're not.
To the journey!
I want you to say right now in front of our friends, okay? And in front of me and the Lord Almighty, what is your favorite season?
Okay. This isn't the favorite season.
I want you to tell me what your favorite season is.
Daniel and Darren, promise we won't ever be like this.
The Ready Room.
So what's the deal? You know, does Tom have a dad we don't know about?
Apparently.
Because who was this guy that he was remembering as his dad?
Was that Nick Locarno's dad?
That was Nick Locarno's dad, yes.
Commentary, Trek Stars.
But I mean, here's the question, John. If you're living Fight Club, then, you know, we have to ask. If you could fight anyone, who would you fight?
William Shatner.
All right.
Literary Treks.
the main storyline here is the battle for the Vulcan soul. They are one of the most logical races, and yet they have an intensely spiritual aspect to them.
Axanar, the official podcast.
You were there. Mm. How long did we wait for them to try and reach that
footage? Oh, man. It was at least as long as the Enterprise penetrating V'ger's outer shield to getting into the actual machine core.
The 602 Club.
So, as far as the realism question is concerned, whether or not it's the right thing to do, it's the Marvel way to do it. I mean, I think that's the defining difference between Marvel and DC.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Absolutely, Norm. These are all such great shows, and we get such great feedback from listeners. No matter what part of Star Trek you love, you're going to find it being discussed here on the network. So check out all of these shows anywhere you get your podcasts. You can find them in iTunes, on Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, SoundCloud, BlackBerry. You can go to the website and stream from the show page. You can download the audio file from the show page on the website, or grab the RSS feed if you want to pop that into some third-party application that we don't even know about yet. There are so many ways for you to listen, so go grab the shows and click subscribe if you're in iTunes. That helps us out a lot. And also, take a moment and leave us a star rating and a written review. We love to hear what you think about the shows, and those also help us rise up in the search results, and that makes it easier for Star Trek fans to find The Ready Room as they're searching for podcasts there in the iTunes store. You can also review us on Stitcher, and I think you can leave star ratings there as well these days. Most of the services are starting to offer that capability, so we really appreciate the feedback from you there. Now, if you'd like to share your thoughts on today's show, there are many ways for you to get in touch with us, but if you want to have a great discussion, not only with us, but with other listeners of the network, the best place to do that is really on Facebook in the Babel Conference. Norm, tell everyone what the Babel Conference is.
Well, the Babel Conference is our Facebook dedicated listeners page, where listeners and fans of the network can come in and talk about all the things that we've been talking about on the network. All the subjects that matter to you, because what we like doing in the Babel Conference, we like continuing the conversation, either from an episode of Trek FM that you've already listened to and you want to just expound on that a little more, or to something completely new. This is where all of us as fans love to come and talk about what matters most to us on Trek FM and in Star Trek in general. So join us on the Babel Conference. That's B-A-B-E-L in your search engine on Facebook. And please join us and continue the conversation.
Absolutely. Yeah, we have such great discussions over there, and it is a closed group. So when you find it, you're going to need to click join, and then we'll let you right in. And one reason that it is a closed group is that it's really designed just for our listeners. So we only promote it here on the air, on the shows. And as a result, we just really have great conversations there that are different than what you're accustomed to on Facebook in the large open groups. We have, I feel, much more meaningful discussions there. And, you know, we'll drop a show, people will listen, they'll come in, and then we'll have, like, the most recent episode of The Orb. I think we've got, like, a 40 or 50 post discussion about Rocks and Shoals going on right now, just on that. So it's a really great place. And on our website, also, if you click discussion up on the menu bar, that'll take you over there as well. So we hope to see you there. And other ways you can get in touch with us include Twitter. Our username is TrekFM. Also, we have our main Facebook page, facebook.com/TrekFM, which is run by Suzanne Abbott. She puts out questions every single day for you there on that page. And you can also send us an email, trek.fm/contact, or send us a voicemail, speakpipe.com/TrekFM. And we'd love to hear from you in any of those ways. Now, Norm, what if people want to get in touch with you when you're not, you know, sitting down drinking some blood wine with Kolos? Where can people find you?
Well, you can always find me here on the network as the host for Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise show. And as we mentioned before, I am always on the Babel Conference, and I would love to discuss anything that you would like to discuss in the Trek universe and beyond on the Babel Conference. So it's Norman Lau, that's N-O-R-M-A-N-L-A-O, and that's the exact same address for Twitter. N-O-R-M-A-N-L-A-O. So I'm there as well, helping the discussion continue. I'm also a proud supporter of Alec Peters and the Axanar Project, and you can find me on the dedicated Axanar page on Facebook. And I love saying this, Chris, because I truly, truly, truly am honored to be a proud sponsor of Trek FM through Patreon. and I am an associate producer of four shows here on the network: Warp 5, The Orb, The 602 Club, and Axanar, the official Axanar podcast.
And we really appreciate your support, Norm. And everyone, do send Norm a thank you, because Norm, as well as Will, who was on with us today, also a patron of the network there on Patreon, and is really thanks to these guys that these shows are coming to you every day of the week, because we really could not do it without their support and the support of all of our other patrons. And I'd also like to send a big thank you to our associate producer here on the Ready Room, Renee Roberts, who supports us through Patreon, but has really supported me and the network since the very beginning. I've known Renee almost since the first podcast came out, so I really appreciate her support. You can find her on Twitter at Mress_1701. That's M-R-E-S-S, like the character from the animated series. So thank you so much, Renee, for your support. And everyone else, yeah, check us out on Patreon, patreon.com/trekfm. You can find everything you need to know there. You can set any amount that you would like to contribute each month. And we are a listener-supported network, and we hope that you'll go there and join all of our other wonderful patrons and help keep Star Trek discussion coming. Now, if you'd like to contact me and chat about Star Trek, I would love to talk to you. You can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, a letter C and Brian with a Y. You can also find me there in the Babel Conference. I'm also on Facebook, same username. And you can find my personal website, cbrianjones.com. And not a lot there about Star Trek, but if you want to follow other things that I do, you can find out about that over there. And then elsewhere on the network, you can find me on The Orb with Matthew Rushing, where we talk all things Deep Space Nine. See, Norm, we are one day going to turn you into a Niner.
Slowly but surely, but it is happening as we, well, not necessarily speak right now, but it is happening behind the scenes for sure.
Behind the scenes, yes. The gears are in motion. And we're conspiring with Will also.
It's the Obsidian Order. I heard something about them. I heard they're a little bit sneakier than the Tal Shiar.
Yeah, yes, they're much sneakier. So you can find me there on The Orb with Matthew, and then you can also find me doing Hyperchannel from time to time, where I talk about some Star Trek news. Well, Norm, it was a great Ready Room today. I'm going to head off and find Hoshi and find out what she's been doing while all this excitement has been happening with her captain.
It's time to stick Hoshi back in this episode, because the Ready Room is done.